You're listening to After Hours with Amy Lawrence.
Yeah, you can be the greatest, you can be the best, you can be the King Kong banging on your chest.
When your team eventually reaches the promised land, the pinnacle of your sport, then it's that much sweeter if you've had to suffer for it. Think about the great stories in sports. The Cubs.
The Cubs come pouring out of the dugout.
The Cavaliers.
And the impossible has come true.
How about Clemson knocking off Alabama?
Touchdown! With a second love.
We've had so many cool stories in the past 2 years in sports. Expect that your history will be redeemed.
This is After Hours with Amy Lawrence.
Sitting in the Hall of Fame. Yeah. And the world's gonna know your name.
Hall of Fame? Well, on the horizon, Hall of Fame weekend for the pro football world, which means the Hall of Fame game that takes place now on a Thursday. It's a Thursday night prime time because we're such shills for football in this country. We'll even watch the very first preseason game in prime time, though it will have to compete against the Olympics. And even though it's tape delayed, which means you'll find out the results ahead of time, and no doubt it'll be all over the internet and social media. Thursday night is the women's all-around competition in gymnastics. So if you don't watch it live during the day, well, then your opportunity to watch it will come during prime time. It's called Paris in Prime Time on NBC, and Mike Tirico does a great job. So that will go up against the preseason game that will take place. So yeah, it's kind of a big week for both the Olympics as well as for the NFL as they get back to their preseason football. And goodness, August 1st. Are you kidding me? It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. We're hoping to connect with Christopher Clary very soon here on the Infinity Sports Network as he is covering tennis and the Olympic Games in Paris. And he's always been great when we've had him overseas. So at some point this hour, we will connect with him. But you can find me online at A-Law Radio as well as on our Facebook page, After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Without a doubt, my favorite moments of Monday at the Olympic Games, and I know the U.S. women, they crushed Japan and used their size and their strength inside, but without a doubt, the U.S. men's gymnastics team, so even as Simone Biles and the women are the superstars, they attract so much of the attention. The men ended a 16-year drought and were able to win bronze in the team competition, and it was glorious. Their crazy celebrations, their routines, and get to know the name Steven Nedorosic. He is the Carrie Strug of men's gymnastics in 2024. All right, we're excited to welcome Christopher Clary, who is in Paris there to cover the Olympic tennis. But I know, Christopher, you told me in the past that you love Paris. So how is it so far as a host site for the Olympics?
Hey, I'm a little bit biased, Amy. Good to hear your voice.
You too.
My wife is French. My kids are French American, so I'm kind of, I can't be an objective observer here. You know, I'm kind of got a little bit of some skin in the game. But no, it's, you know, the Paris vibe has really gotten good. I mean, it's was a tough, rainy start, as I'm sure a lot of you saw. You know, with the kind of the rainy opening ceremony and the tough weather, but I thought it was still pretty phenomenal attempt to knock it out of the park, and I think in some ways they did. And so I think the vibe has been building in Paris since then. A lot of the streets in the city are quiet outside
really?
Of the venues. You know, it's funny, you walk around, a lot of people from Paris have left. Some people were worried about, you know, just the problems of logistics during the Olympics, and people generally in Paris tend to go away in late July and August anyway. It gets pretty quiet in a lot of neighborhoods, but when you get near the venues, I'm telling you, the atmosphere is amazing. There's been a huge amount of enthusiasm, a lot of people coming across the border from within Europe to come watch the games, a lot of orange shirts from Dutch fans and different sports that I've seen. So I think as long as nothing, you know, unfortunately, you never know with an Olympics, as long as there's no major news event, like something, a terrorist attack, heaven forbid, but as long as that doesn't happen, I think this is going to be a big success, and you can really feel a lot of positive energy around the city and the event.
So I know you're there to cover tennis, but I have to ask, because I heard this as a report, that a lot of places where you look in Paris, there are signs or photos, maybe even life-size, of Léon Marchand, the swimmer, that he's a big star. And the atmosphere was incredible. Have you seen signs of him or his face anywhere?
You know, I mean, there's just wall-to-wall coverage in all the French media. And, and you know, the French are hard to please. But when it comes to, you know, cheering for their teams, once they get into it, then they really kind of abandon all that cynicism and they let it go. And then he's definitely one of the main people in the spotlight here. And there's a lot of focus, this being France, because they really are very good at some sports that in the U.S. are not that big. A lot of focus on stuff like judo or team handball or fencing, which is an amazing venue in the Grand Palais, which is this massive exposition building, which is so grand in the middle of Paris near the Champs-Élysées. I mean, this fencing, team handball, and judo in the U.S. would not, you know, get much coverage. But here in France, it's part of the mainstream coverage, and that's part of the joy of the Olympics, Amy, I think, is to see in these different countries, you know, what gets the focus.
I will tell you this, I've never seen a beach volleyball venue and a backdrop quite like the one they have, which is pretty incredible. If you know nothing about volleyball, but you see the Eiffel Tower rising up behind the sand, that in and of itself is a draw.
Yeah. I mean, I think the best venue at the Paris Olympics is probably about 12 time zones away. It's in Tahiti, if you're looking at some of the pictures of the surfing down there. But that's a tough commute from here. Definitely hard to get there on the metro. So we're going to stick with what we got. And that's the thing about Paris. If everything goes smoothly, the venues are unbeatable. As just the I'm sure you're seeing on TV with the visuals. But even live, I mean, you show up and I lived in Paris a lot of my adult life, and you drive in these places that are always pretty epic. Down to see the Eiffel Tower, but suddenly there's a beach volleyball court, like you say, spotlit, and people are going to Versailles and seeing the horse jumping and the horse cross country events. I mean, it's a great use of this beautiful city, and I wish them well. I hope it goes well for them. You just never know. The security is incredibly tight. A huge amount of force being deployed here, but it's always risky.
Christopher Clary is joining us from Paris, where it's just past 11 o'clock in the morning. He's the founder of Tennis and Beyond, Substack, but longtime tennis insider and reporter. He's got a couple of books as well, and so we're always excited to have him here on the show. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. So we get Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal in the Olympics, although a very familiar venue there at Roland Garros. How did that compare to maybe some of the other matches where you've covered them in Grand Slams?
That's a great question, I was curious because I wasn't. They played once before in the Olympics in Beijing when Nadal got the gold medal in singles back in 2008. But Djokovic wasn't Djokovic then. Rafa beat him in three sets, and that was their only previous Olympic match that they played. They haven't played much in Davis Cups. Almost all their matches have been individual sort of events like Grand Slams or regular ATP events. So this was a different venue, and I thought the. You could tell from the way they were approaching it, there was just huge hype, and it's a different community. You know, the Grand Slam tennis has its fans, people follow it. Once you get to the finals, there's more global interest. But this is interesting because this whole community of Olympic sports, within that community, the tennis players are superstars. They go around the village, and people like Djokovic and Nadal or Andy Murray are getting stopped all the time for selfies, and there's just a huge amount of interest in them. So in a way, you know, you could argue whether Olympic tennis really should even exist, considering there's other sports that maybe deserve more spotlight, and they don't have the same summit points that tennis has. But honestly, it feels pretty important once you see it here in this venue, and it does a lot for the sport. So this event with Djokovic and Nadal, and there's a big, big press area, Amy, up in the Roland Garros Stadium, which we all sat in many times, literally could not get in half an hour before the match started. It was completely packed. All people coming from all over the Olympics, you know, a lot of other athletes, other federation officials, a lot of media that don't usually cover tennis were just jammed into this big, big press box. And I think it's because they knew it could be the last time. People knew no Nadal, no Djokovic. They wanted to see Nadal on clay if they never had. They have it on their checklist. And honestly, you know, it wasn't a great match by their standards. Djokovic really dominated. Rafa made it interesting in the second set. It was it could have been, you know, almost embarrassing for him. It was 6-1, 4-love, two breaks for Djokovic. But then Nadal sort of saved the day a little bit for himself and fought back. But ultimately, it was really a pretty lopsided match by their standards, 6-1, 6-4 in about an hour and a half. But I'm not sure anybody was complaining. They were just happy to check that list and see those guys play.
And Nadal's not done. How cool is it to see he and Carlos Alcaraz competing in doubles?
Yeah, that's the other thing, Amy. You know, tennis doubles tends to be kind of back burner at almost every other event. But the Olympics, because, you know, gold medal's a gold medal.
Yes.
And the stars play. It's almost the same thing as the singles in terms of the interest. So they're playing on the, when they played on the Chatrier court, the main court with Nadal and Alcaraz, if you want to call it that, the other night. I mean, it's 15,000 people. It was completely packed. It felt like it was a gold medal match, just huge atmosphere. So that's a lot of fun to see doubles, which is a really undervalued thing in my view in tennis, get its moment in the sunshine or the rain under the roof, whatever it's going to be. But and they're playing again tonight. And the other thing is they also have Andy Murray's potentially last match is tonight.
Right.
They're playing back-to-back doubles on the second court at the at Roland Garros. Andy Murray with Dan Evans. I was on court a couple of days ago when Andy was playing what looked like his last match. He was had five match points against them in the last third set tiebreaker, and I was taking pictures on my phone of Andy's last point, but he kept making me delete him because, you know, he was five in a row. They say five match points, five career points in a row, and they live this to play another day. So they'll all be out there, not playing each other, but they're going to be out there today on the Longland court.
That atmosphere for Andy Murray and his roars, it was just unadulterated joy as they, as you talk about, they erased all those match points against the Japanese team and were able to stay alive. I mean, it seemed like, just watching it on TV, that the atmosphere was incredible. I can imagine it was awesome to be there.
You know, it's funny because most of the main court matches have been completely packed. That was the end of the day, so it's probably a half full. But it was a bunch of Brits, so the Brits were just lighting it up and waving the Union Jack or, you know, waving their Scottish flags, too, and shouting out. And, it, you know, and honestly, I think Andy was just kind of lit from within. And so was Dan Evans, his partner. I think they hugged far too many times, but they hugged a lot. And it was great to see. And it was loud, despite being half full. And tonight will not be half full.
So I know that Andy Murray is done after this. He said that unequivocally. But Rafa seems to hedge a little bit. What's your sense after hearing from him post-match about his tennis future?
Yeah, great point, Amy. He's been kind of doing serial hedging for the last couple of months. he was they gave him a farewell ceremony in Madrid. He's Spanish, obviously. He likes Madrid as a concept, but doesn't like playing tennis there because of the altitude and just a bunch of different things. So he said goodbye there, definitively. And then he went to Rome, and then he refused the idea of the ceremony, you know, the farewell thing. I go, Then he comes to Paris and refuses that. So, I mean, he wants to keep playing. I mean, he put a lot of effort into coming back from this big hip injury that he had. It's been a year rehabbing. He's got his young son, Rafael Jr., following around with his wife, Mary. His wife, Mary, seems to enjoy the circuit. I mean, he can keep going if he can be healthy. But I'm just not sure how much tolerance for pain he's going to have of losing to his big rivals like he did yesterday on his favorite surface and things like that. So, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if he called it a day by the end of the fall here. But I think he's going to try to keep playing for the rest of the season.
It's kind of surprising. And you and I had spoken, going back to the French, that Novak was even able to play at Wimbledon and now in the Olympics. And we had talked about it then. At 38 years old, not sure how many more of these opportunities will come along. So how much would it matter to him to capture a gold medal?
Look, I'm just going to correct you. I mean, I never correct you, but he's 37.
Sorry, 37.
Just so
Thank
we
you.
Know, yeah, that's true for him. It matters more.
Oh, Rafa's
matters,
38, right? Rafa's 38.
No, absolutely. I can see why we're all getting. We don't even know anymore. These guys are just ancient. But yeah, but Novak, I thought Novak played in patches yesterday. Tremendous tennis. He was moving well, striking his the backhand especially, which is his canary in the coal mine shot. He was striking it so well, really dominating with that stroke. Serve looked pretty good. So, I mean, I think based on the, because of injuries and withdrawals, only five of the top 10 men came into this tournament. He has an excellent draw in the early part of the tournament now. He's going to play Dominic Kupfer in the third round tomorrow, which is the round of 16 at the Olympics, and you got to think Novak's a big favorite in that match. And he would play Baez or Tsitsipas in the quarterfinals. Both those guys are tough on clay. Tsitsipas played him in the final of the French Open a couple years ago. But Novak in this form, I think, is, you look at the guys who are in the draw, people like Casper Ruud, obviously Carlos Alcaraz, Alex Zverev. Those guys are the ones that are the danger zone. So, Zverev and Novak maybe in the semis would be a match that could knock him out. But he's looking very motivated. He's not playing anything else but singles here. No doubles this time for Serbia. All the energy at age 37 is going into this this last quest for a gold medal at the Olympics, which he doesn't have.
Yeah. Christopher Clary is with us from Paris as the Olympics are underway again now. It's just past 11 o'clock in the morning. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. So Coco Gauff has a chance to compete now in these Olympics, where she didn't, obviously, when she's a teenager in Tokyo, ended up with COVID, so had to bow out. And it's so neat for her to be able to hold the flag, not so much lead the contingent, but hold the flag there on the boat. And now she's 3-0. It seems now at 20, I know the ripe old age of 20, that she comes in maybe more prepared for everything that, you know, happens with the attention on her and just the general pressure of an Olympic Games.
Yeah, one of my favorite moments of the Olympics so far was the moment when she heard about, you know, being able to carry the flag. I mean, it was legitimate shock. It was just great to see. She's with her teammates, or Chris Eubanks, who's known her since she was a little kid, was the one who's her teammate who told her about it in front of the whole team, and it was just great to see her reaction. And obviously, it wasn't your typical flag carrying experience on the boat through the rain in Paris, but I don't think she cared, and it was obviously really powerful for her to have that next to LeBron and everything. So she's kind of living the dream. She's always wanted to play at the Olympics. You know, her parents were basketball players and track and field athletes, so for them, the Olympics has always been a big deal in their family, and it's very meaningful to her, and you can tell she's very motivated, and, you know, she's got a shot. She's in three events. You know, she's playing on her own. She's playing with Jesse Pegula and the doubles. They've been one of the best teams in the world for a couple of years now, and she's playing with Taylor Fritz in the mix. So she's got a big schedule, but she's young and strong. She can do it. I don't think she's the favorite, though, honestly, in any of those events. So to get the gold, I think she's got a good shot at medals and perhaps all three for sure. But I think the gold, that's going to be tricky for her. But she's playing well, and she has a match today against Dana Vekic, who's a semifinalist at Wimbledon from Croatia just recently. And then she could play potentially Maria Sakkari or Marta Kostyuk of Ukraine in the quarterfinals. But I think Coco is a very good bet to get to the final here, and maybe she would probably face her bete noire, to use a French term, Iga Świątek, the top seed, who's in the other half of the draw.
I don't know whether or not you follow TikTok, but I know you're very informed. So Coco and some of her teammates put it out on TikTok that the bets were pretty rough at the Olympic Village, and apparently the entire team has moved to a hotel as opposed to staying there.
Yeah, those cardboard beds are great for the ecology, but not so great for the performance from what I'm hearing. Yeah. The athletes are sort of saying cardboard bed with a kind of wincing as they say it. So that might have been one bad move from the Paris organizers. I wasn't aware, honestly, that Coco and the guys had left. It would not be unprecedented, and it makes sense. You got a lot of matches to play. You want to do your best. If it's not working, it's not working. But she's enjoying it. You can tell she had like a Snoop Dogg pin with the five Olympic rings in a way I won't describe, that she was showing off here at the venue yesterday, and she's having a good time.
I was about to ask you, just to wrap up, how much have you seen Snoop Dogg at different tennis events?
Well, yesterday he was ubiquitous, but I mean, it was, I love the intergenerational Snoop Dogg and Billie Jean King side by side in the stands. That was a couple people from Long Beach, right? So it was great to see.
What's next for you after the Olympics, Chris?
Well, I'm actually going to watch more than tennis second week, Amy.
Nice.
That's my goal. I'm going to get out to the track and field, which I also have covered a lot of and love. And I'm working on my next book. I'm working on my book on Federer, the Master, which is still out. I'm doing a book on Nadal called The Warrior. It'll be out next year. And I'm working on my website, Tennis and Beyond, that I started, which has got a lot of tennis inside articles in it, and I've been really enjoying that. So my 30 years of the New York Times Daily Journalism, I thought I was sort of semi-retiring, but nope, I'm having fun doing all this.
Yeah, this is more fun, especially with the Olympics in Paris. But I just, and this is like triggered a thought, the last time I talked to you said you had to keep extending the deadline for the Nadal book because he wasn't done. So are you going to put it out there anyway, even though we're not sure?
You know, I'm not going to promise anything. That's exactly right. We've had to push it back because, you know, we thought Rafa was pretty much done, and he's coming back. And on clay, even though he got beaten yesterday, 1-4, you just can't count him out if he's, you know, fully locked and loaded. So we've been waiting a while. I think next year is the right time. I think there's a good chance he'll try to play the French Open again next year.
Oh, cool.
And maybe that be his farewell. But we'll see. It's all going to depend how the body holds up and sort of how the ego holds up, I think, over the next few months.
Well, we appreciate your time. As always, you can find Christopher Clary on Twix, is what I call it now, at Christoph Clary.
I like that.
C-L-A-R-E-Y. But he's got Tennis and Beyond, Substack. The Master is the Federer book. It's awesome. And The Warrior's coming out soon. So never a dull moment in his world. Great to catch up with you in Paris again. And I hope that you enjoy the rest of the games.
I hope you enjoy it too, Amy. Good to talk to you as always.
Thank you. Appreciate the time. Yeah, good stuff. And I knew that he would be a great ambassador, so to speak, as he says right off the top, since he is biased in favor of Paris because of his wife and his kids and just having lived so much of his life there. So great to talk to him, as I told you guys. If you listen to too many Christopher Clary conversations and interviews and read his stuff online, you become much smarter. So beware. You've been forewarned. Let's see. What are we going to do? From there, a little bit of this USA men's gymnastics team. Before the women completely dominate the headlines, it was such a cool moment for them on Monday. And also, we may have found a hockey player disguised as a baseball catcher. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence on Facebook, online. You can find me at A-Law Radio. Good morning to you on a Tuesday here on the Infinity Sports Network.
I mean, it feels amazing because, I mean, we had some highs and lows. You know, qualifications wasn't perfect. But I had no doubt in this team and it showed today. We all came together when it mattered and we did something great for our country.
Here's Amy Lawrence.
That is the voice of Brody Malone, the de facto leader of the men's USA gymnastics squad, who is the only returning Olympian. And as he tells NBC, it's an incredible story, an incredible arc for them because they actually didn't qualify that well, but they outperformed all of their qualifying scores when it came to those moments that mattered. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. If you have not seen it, it is phenomenal to watch. And I know NBC has replayed it overnight, but I've also seen a bunch of the routines on YouTube. They're easy to find as we've been in search of the reaction. This has got to be one of those moments that we'll remember years down the road. I think similar to a Carrie Strug going back to her vault on a bulky ankle in the Atlanta Olympics, for those of you who remember with me, and having to be carried out to get her gold medal with Team USA and Dominique Mocianu and Dominique Dawes and Shannon Miller on that team as well. Amy Chow. I mean, I don't remember a ton about the Atlanta Olympics. They were obviously a long time ago, but I remember Janet Evans handing off to Muhammad Ali. I remember him being the big surprise at the games. I definitely remember the USA women's gymnastics team winning the gold in such dramatic fashion. And now I wonder if this might be a moment that I look back on and I remember because it was so powerful and it was so emotional. Yes, Simone Biles and the U.S. women deserve a ton of the spotlight. They will get it back on Tuesday because the team final, and remember, they're ahead by more than 5 points after qualifying rounds. So they go into the final as the undisputed, not just champion, well, champion. They are silver medalists from Tokyo, but as the undisputed team to beat, and Simone Biles now trying to capture that all-around competition. It was won by Suni going back to Tokyo, but they are the big bads, if you will. They flex their muscles. They are the team to beat on this Olympic stage and on the world stage, whereas the U.S. men had not medaled in the Olympics in 16 years. They often get forgotten because the women are so good and are so full of star power.
Kind of like the soccer team.
True. Good point. And here you have a roster full of guys who have never competed in the Olympics before. But they go out there on Monday and steadily build their case and boost their scores as each of them in turn performs a routine that gets the crowd hyped up, the American fans that were there, but not just that, them. Their crazy celebrations, their unadulterated joy and exultation after almost every routine. And they build on it, and they continue working, continue through the 5.5 rotations until they get to Steven Nedorosic. I'm telling you, that's the Carrie Strug of the 2024 Olympic Games. One routine. That's all he does. He's a pommel horse specialist. That's it. They took him to Paris because he is a former world champion on this event and because he's that good on this event, the pommel horse. And so if you watch any of the highlights of their team competition, what you see is the rest of them going out there and performing all the different rotations. So the high bar, the rings, the floor exercise, the pommel horse, all that stuff. They're all out there except for him. He's a lot of the times pictured in the background sitting along the sidelines, glasses on. That's how you know it's him. Glasses on, eyes closed, meditating. So the chaos is unfolding all around him. His team is going nuts. Not that he doesn't smile. You'll catch a smile on his face every now and then. But he was preparing for his moment. And he nailed it. It was a near flawless pommel horse routine. And even though he took out one of the elements, he had a couple of really difficult elements in there. And the second he goes up for the dismount, he actually said he thought he was smiling already. He lands, he plants both feet, and the celebration turns into just total chaos. He gets lifted up and carried around by his teammates. Now, they had to wait for his score and then wait for officially their bronze medal scores to pop up on the board. But when it did, the celebration just continued. So it was awesome. Leaping, jumping, I guess that's what they do. A bunch of guys who've never been there before, but now have solidified their place in history. So it's kind of fun. He and the rest of the U.S. men sat down with Mike Tirico, bronze medals around their necks, right? And they're watching the final moments of his pommel horse routine, which was their last routine to solidify the bronze medal.
Right here, I was super worried in my routine. And I was like, let's just get it done. Let's go for it. And right here, I was like, if I put this dismount up, Team USA gets a medal. I think you could see it right away when I land. Oh, dude, goosebumps right now, man. That's the best moment of my life.
How about that? So he's rewatching it with Mike Tirico and with the rest of his team. And you can hear him, the giant smile on his face, going through it amidst the nerves, the worries, like, uh-oh, this is a really important moment. And man, if I can just land this dismount, we are bronze medalists. And yeah, you can hear, too, kind of the reaction of his
best
team.
Best moment of my life.
Around him, which is pretty amazing. But he also has to sit and watch every other routine and watch his teammates go around and around. And they are all performing and celebrating. And as I say, he has to wait for hours before it's his turn.
I have this thing where it's like, if everyone hits before me, I've never missed. During that dismount, I was just like already smiling, I think. I saluted the judges and looked at these guys and they were jumping up and down. I mean, it was just the greatest moment of my life, I think. So happy to have been there.
He repeats it again because, as you can imagine, for all of these guys, you practice, you train, you battle through injuries. And in Steven's case, he's a star at Penn State, so they have their own lives as well. Many of them revolve around Olympics, just like the women. They compete all over the country at various places. But for Steven, this is the one thing. You know that goofy line? You had one job. This is it. This is Steven's job. Steven's job is to nail the pommel horse routine.
Best moment of my life.
And he does it. Imagine how you felt the last time you rose to the occasion. You performed under pressure. Maybe you delivered the perfect presentation over Zoom. Maybe you stood in front of your bosses and you gave them all the reasons why you deserved a raise. And you got it. Maybe if you're a student, you had to stand in front of a board, maybe, or professors and deliver a thesis, whatever it is. You get done. You've done it to the best of your ability. You nailed it. You crushed it. You know. That's the emotion for Steven Nedorosic and the
best
U.S. men.
Best moment of my life.
Best moment of my life. And as you can imagine, and for Brody Malone, again, the kind of the leader of the squad, is the only returning Olympian, the hours that followed after they clinched the bronze were delicious.
It's been a little bit crazy. I mean, afterwards, we got pushed back to, you know, do the medal ceremony, and then we had a bunch of media, and then we got to see our parents for like a half hour, 45 minutes, and then we got in a van, came straight here.
So they are now I say the darlings because that's kind of reserved for the women, but they certainly are the story of the Olympics for Team USA to this point because it wasn't expected. And that's kind of the fun stuff is the stories that get unearthed and uncovered and that unfold over the course of the Olympics. And the unexpected, I think, are the ones that I appreciate the most. But also the fact that, and if you haven't seen the videos, it's amazing. They had their parents or loved ones with them. So they're living in dying with every twist and turn and routine. And you hear Brody talk about their reunions with their families. Yeah, the NBC cameras caught them where they were able to share their medals with their parents and their families. And it's just, it's amazing. Talk about emotional. The tears, the joy. I mean, that's what they pour into it, right? Blood, sweat, and tears. It's everything for them. And we may not know their names, but this is something they've poured years, decades into. So yes, Simone Biles, Suni Lee, the women, they're household names in many cases. These men, they kind of came out of nowhere and yet delivered. That's what sports is all about, right? Rising to the occasion.
Yeah, nobody thought about the men. Can you believe that? Nobody thought about the men here in this competition. And you know what? We showed them.
Boom!
Go men.
Go men. Go red, white, and blue. Go USA. Yeah, I mean, it's been a while, right? It's been 16 years. Not that the U.S. hasn't won medals in the past, but just that it's been such a long drought.
08 in Beijing, yeah.
The Chinese and the Japanese, the Russians. I mean, it's a sport that's been dominated on the men's side. But I'm so excited for them. By the way, if you're up early on the East Coast or if you're up early on the West Coast, it would be super early, right? But Greece and Spain playing in basketball, which means, of course, Giannis is... I got Manny off guard. He's ready to find it. I do not know which network, so you have to let me know when you know. I know USA has swimming right now, so you have to let me know when you find it.
Oh, then that means it's probably on E.
E or Peacock.
Mm.
They do that to us. We're supposed to have access to a Peacock account in here, but we're also supposed to have access to Zoom, and I haven't found that yet either. All right. Thanks for hanging out with us. Good morning to you. Seeing red, white, and blue Olympic rings. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Here's our latest sports update, and here's Marco Belletti.
Here's the high hole pitch. Up and in, and that got McCann in the helmet. He goes down in a heap. Brian Ebel, the trainer, is out along with Brandon Hyde. Oh, man.
Oh, no. I mean, obviously no intent. Yariel Rodriguez has no idea where the ball is going. He got him in the face, Jeff. He's bleeding right on the field.
Yeah, they are taking a towel over towards McCann, who is bleeding, and Brian Ebel is attending to McCann, who is down on his chest.
He doesn't have a head or eye trauma or injury. We're suspecting he has a broken nose. He's going to get a CT scan tomorrow, and he's going to see our ear, nose, and throat specialist. And, you know, all signs right now are that we dodged a major bullet.
Here's Amy Lawrence.
That is the voice of one Brandon Hyde, and before that, Orioles Radio Network. We have found the hockey player who is disguised by his catcher's mask and is masquerading as a baseball player. Did you guys see the bruised and battered face of one James McCann? Oh my goodness. Really impressive that, first of all, he was able to get up. I mean, that in and of itself was enough that he was able to get up. But the fact that he also stayed in the game, this happened in the first inning of the opener of a doubleheader between the Orioles and the Blue Jays, and he kind of shrugs it off, I guess. And I mean, I don't want to be too chippy about it. He certainly was in pain, and he had to stuff some gauze up his nose, and his face was bloody. But to see him afterwards with what appears to be swelling, I don't know how bad it got overnight, but generally, you'd think the second day is the worst. Yeah, he gets hit in the face by a fastball and decides he's going to stay in the game. How in the world did he do that? I mean, we're talking about a moment that, gosh, where your life kind of flashes before your eyes and you think that could have been direct hit to the eye or to the jaw.
I think at first it's more scary than anything. I guess like taking a pretty good punch, pretty good right hook, I guess. Now it's just the swelling that's kind of set in and hard to see a little bit. But other than that, it's good.
That was a scary scene and just shows you how tough that guy is. You know, it's to get hit like that, to have the blood not stop coming out of his nose and his mouth. He seemed like he was in good conscious. He seemed like he was fine. It just, there was obviously dazed and the blood wasn't stopping. But just a really, really scary scene. He is incredibly, incredibly tough. He goes and catches eight mornings after that.
Yeah, that's, man, gosh, that's hockey territory while we're talking about it. So the pitcher ends up getting removed from the game, which gave them a little extra time. I can imagine he was shaken up as well. And so in that time, they're able to get the bleeding to stop. And so McCann then goes back out there on the field as a runner at first base.
Yeah, why not?
Ooh, could you imagine what it felt like to run with a broken nose?
Mm-mm.
Oh, man. I've never had a broken bone. Have you had any broken bones?
Yeah, I broke a finger once. I was playing goalkeeper, playing soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't catch the ball as I intended. It's
ouch.
Yeah, my left ring finger.
Okay, so this, I'm sure that was painful.
Wasn't great.
This thankfully hit him in the helmet, but it actually knocked his helmet off, which always blows my mind that a ball can be traveling, in this case, with 95 miles per hour. And yes, the helmet does its job and stops the ball, but it the impact of it knocked his helmet off. I mean, that's crazy. It's like popping it off, pop off the top of a bottle, or, well, I guess sometimes you need the top, right, for a, like, depending if it's a twist or not, you need the bottle opener, but how it pops it off. I mean, that's what I was thinking of. So yeah, he had blood everywhere and they were able to get it stopped up, and he's wearing gauze and he looks like he's gone three rounds with Mike Tyson.
It reminds me of when Giancarlo Stanton was up at the dish still as a member of the Marlins. I think it was against, was it Mike Fiers against the Brewers up in Milwaukee? It was definitely It was definitely against the Brewers in Milwaukee. I definitely remember that. Yeah, and Giancarlo Stanton just took a fastball right off the face, and he actually needed to get surgery, reconstructional surgery on his face for after that impact.
Plastic surgery?
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah. So could you imagine, though, if you're a McCann and you have to get back in the batter's box, not facing the same guy,
no,
but I've heard from other athletes who've gotten hit in the face or hit in the head, and there's a little bit of kind of, I don't want to say PTSD, making light of it, but just the flashbacks of that ball beaning you.
Not even close to the same level, but when I played Little League Baseball, there was this kid... There was this kid who got hit by a pitch, wasn't wearing a cage, got hit by a pitch, broke his nose, and then for the rest of the season, after he came back, he was afraid to get back in the batter's box, even though we gave him a helmet with a cage. So, I mean, it's obviously not, I'm comparing apples and wrenches over here, but I mean, yeah, there is that factor of, I'm afraid I'm going to get hit again in the face.
All right, man. I'm so glad he's okay, but broken nose aside, I mean, kind of wonder, he did not play in the second half of the doubleheader.
Oh, he didn't?
No, he did not. It was strange. I missed him. Kind of wonder, though, like what they might have to do. Stop it. You apologize right this second.
I'm sorry, soft Jake McCann.
You kind of wonder what they might have to do to adjust his helmet or his mask, I should say, and how that might, if it's just a plain old normal catcher's mitt or catcher's mask, how it might affect his nose and just wear some of those crossbars. I know they're padded, but still, any little impact with the nose, you got to imagine, is just brutal. Oh, or as Manny suggested earlier, maybe he'll wear a plastic face mask underneath his catcher's mask, because that wouldn't be uncomfortable at all.
No, of course not.
And
it's tough too. I don't know what type of catcher's mask he uses, but I mean the new ones they're not really great, because you get hit a foul tip and it kind of rattles in your head with the new hockey mask that they have. But then you have the old catcher's mask, and that you kind of graze up on that, and the mask hits you in the face and in the nose. It's going to be tough.
I want to use it as my example, my validation of this is why it's the only position on the softball field that I never played was catcher, except that he didn't get hit when he was behind the plate, so I can't really use that. It would be kind of me being soft. No, I was always afraid of getting hit by the bat when it came around. Just and still, every now and then, you'll see it because there's tight quarters there. But this was not when he was catching. Just incredible, the visual of him with a black eye and dried blood on his face and two pieces of gauze swelling. Yeah, he's starting to swell up like a pufferfish. And he's got two pieces of gauze coming out of his nose. And he's just out there on first base, hanging out. Let's go. Let's do this thing. So, yes, we have found the one hockey player who, when he's not sticking to his day job, is masquerading as an Orioles catcher. Wow, James McCann, you're my hero. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Now, I would suppose that Mike Tomlin, because he's tough and strong and all, that he would think that was just all in a day's work. Because we do not yet have a full-time producer, we are working out different producers, Manny being one. It's great to have him this week. Those who are filling in don't know how much I love Mike Tomlin. And I heard this in Marco Belletti's update and decided we needed to end with a little bit of Mike Tomlin to shove you into your Tuesday. I mean, he's just got such a unique way of putting everything.
Another really good acclimation day. Now we'll have a day off, and we'll get into the real meat of this, man, as we carry our pass next week, and it'll be more football-like. Great opportunity to teach and learn, and great opportunity to show what their capabilities are. So we're really excited about that.
Have you ever in your entire life heard any other human being put those two words together, acclimation day, an acclimation day? And then he talks about how we'll be carrying the pads. It'll be a lot more football-like. Acclimation day.
It's foosball season.
No one talks like him, and it's amazing. I often say that if I could have any co-host from the sports world, it would be Draymond Green, because you're going to get a whole lot of radio gold with Draymond Green, and I really enjoy his podcast. Although Micah Parsons would be fun, except I think Micah cheats. You can tell with his podcast where there are portions of it that he's had to redo and where it's been edited because there's a bunch of sound effects. Yeah, Draymond would be amazing, and Mike Tomlin. Mike Tomlin would be amazing. I hear he is big into the chicken wings. We can maybe entice him with some buffalo chicken wings. That might be flashbacks of Buffalo, though. All right, we'll talk to you tonight. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Boom!